You are listening to Holy Heresy, a podcast that explores the evolution of faith in these challenging times. Whether you have a lot of faith, a little faith, absolutely no faith, or are of another faith, it is our hope that these podcasts will help you find your place in the ongoing conversation that has been evolving forever. This series on banned books is brought to you by First Congregational Church of Los Angeles.
During this season of Eastertide, we've been doing a series on banned books, both books that have been banned in recent times and the material that didn't make it into the Bible as we know it today. The book featured on your bulletin cover, Heather Has Two Mommies, is an important children's book. When it was first published 30 years ago, it was one of the first books to include a family with same-sex parents. Over the past three decades, it continued to make the list of most banned books in the U.S. And as we know, representation matters, especially for children. There's even a clinical term for this concept, symbolic annihilation, which means if you don't see yourself represented or reflected in society and or in media, you essentially feel like you don't exist. This book served as a source of comfort for countless children who grew up in what was considered at the time a non-traditional family, reassuring any child with two moms or two dads that they are not alone, and what is most important in a family is the love shared and not the gender of the parental figures. But looking at that bulletin cover today, well, let's just say that it hits differently than it did last week. Even before this week, I know it won't come as a shock, but it's been a rough time to be a parent. I have friends who have been panicked in recent days that they might not be able to feed their baby because they aren't able to breastfeed and the only type of formula that their baby can take isn't available online or in local stores. Local Facebook groups have sprung into action trying to connect desperate parents with up-to-date info on which stores have certain formula in stock and giving generously of whatever formula or extra breast milk they might have available to give. And whether you're raising a baby or a toddler or a kid or a teen through years of a pandemic, this has been a trying time. Parents are weary from the toll of the last 2 years of being in survivor mode, toggling between what are we doing now? Is it mass? Is it in school, at home? This one tested positive, canceled plans, juggling childcare, and then the one child gets a cold, and so they have to stay at home for a week. School systems being stretched to the brink because of lack of teachers and administrators, and everyone is doing the best they can with less and less resources. And so here we are in the season of Eastertide. And we hear the words of our scripture this morning. The story of the days that followed Jesus' death, and how the women who were closest to Jesus awoke early on that Easter morning, bringing the supplies to prepare his body for what would come next, now that he had died. And there's actually four versions of this story in the Bible, one in each of the four Gospels. In Luke, the version we read this morning, when the women find the empty tomb, they rush to tell the disciples what they have discovered, only to be told that the disciples don't believe them. A fun line in the NIV translation of Luke reads, "But they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like utter nonsense." Peter then goes to visit the tomb to check it out for himself and finds that the women were right. In Matthew and Mark, the women were so terrified that even though they were instructed by the two angels to go and tell the disciples what they had saw, they ran away in fear and told no one. And in John, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb alone. And in addition to the visit from the two angels, she is the first to encounter the resurrected Christ a tearful reunion, to be sure. A few hundred years after Jesus' death, there were all these different Christian communities spread throughout different countries and cultural groups, each as unique as the people who made up these communities. And at some point, they decided that they needed to get together and get everyone on the same page, to agree on some basic theological stuff, like who was Jesus and how was he both divine and human and what exactly was Jesus' relationship to God. And it was also around that time that they were deciding what should be included in the Bible and what shouldn't. So you'd think, since this was a time of consolidating belief, a time where they were forcing people to either agree or be exiled, that they would have landed on just one version of the resurrection story. I mean, it's kind of the most important story of Jesus's life. Wouldn't they want to get just one accurate account, or the closest they could find to that, and then just throw out the other ones? Why even have four gospels? Four versions of Jesus's life, each with a slightly different take on who he was and what he did and what it meant for us, Jesus's followers. Instead of throwing aside these differing accounts, they placed the four gospels side by side, giving each of them their own space to tell the story of Jesus's life as they understood it, each version telling us something important about who Jesus was, even when it conflicted with the other stories, which in turn allows us, thousands of years later, to enter into whichever Easter story we choose, to listen for the truths waiting for us amongst the pages. Okay, so now here's the hard part. Tuesday happened. An 18-year-old bought two semi-automatic assault-style rifles and 1,600 rounds of ammunition, shot and killed 19 fourth graders and two teachers. You don't have to be a parent to be gutted by the events of Uvalde, Texas. But I will say that holding my baby this week as she slept, knowing that the parents of those children we'll never get to hold them again, was a feeling beyond words. And the horror seemed to have no end as we learned about the 911 calls of the children trapped inside, and as our nation grappled with the possibility that they might have lived if law enforcement had entered the classroom sooner. Guns are now the number one cause of death among children and teens in the U.S., overtaking automobile deaths for the first time. Over the past 10 years, the firearm suicide rate has more than doubled among Black, Latino, and Asian teens. Even though the U.S. makes up only 4% of our world's population, we own almost half, 46%, of all privately owned guns in the world. And an analysis of all mass shootings at elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools found that 80% of mass shooters stole their guns from family members. Uvalde was the 27th school shooting this year. I don't share these statistics to overwhelm you, but I say them because this is our reality. I know it is so understandable to think, well, if we weren't able to do something after Sandy Hook or Parkland, Florida, or any of the 950 school shootings since Sandy Hook, or any of the mass shootings, including Boulder, Colorado, or even here in California, well, then nothing can be done. Scrolling through the memes and the opinion articles, listening to politicians go after one another, hopelessness is a perfectly reasonable reaction. I'm pretty sure that the women who visited Jesus' tomb were also filled with hopelessness, consumed with grief for the loss of the one who was the embodiment of hope, who had been murdered and buried. They had lovingly prepared ointments and spices to anoint his body. They went about the tasks at hand, without hope that it would bring their loved one back. Even though the time for hoping for a miracle had passed, they got up that morning and they did the work that was theirs to do. Like the women at the tomb, we must dedicate ourselves to the work in front of us before the clouds of hopelessness have parted. It is in these moments when we are weary and hopeless that our efforts are needed most. And I know that some of you might feel like you can't. Maybe you are just trying to get through this moment without falling apart, and that's okay too. But when you're ready, we need you to join us. As we survey the damage and divisiveness surrounding us, they would have us believe that all is lost, that the other side is to blame, and they will never let us win. But in truth, there is more common ground to be found here than you might think. The majority of Americans, including gun owners, including NRA members, are in support of some form of legislation that strengthens background checks and red flag laws. There are organizations working right now to get legislation passed that would help close loopholes in background checks and increase age limits for gun ownership. And it won't happen tomorrow or next week. But that doesn't mean that what we do now is unimportant. I was reminded this week by Amanda Doyle that it took a 100-year-long fight for women to secure the right to vote. It took a 100-year-long fight after the Civil War to end legalized racial segregation. And please, God, may it not take 100 years for us to address gun violence in our country. But what would have happened if 10 years into that 100-year-long fight, if the people had decided that things were hopeless because they couldn't see systemic change yet? We've listed a few ways that you can get involved in our meeting house this week, but I would encourage you to spend some time thinking about what specific ways you might do the work we are all called to do as Christians to bring about God's kingdom here on earth. Because if we have seen with our own two eyes over and over again, as Nelson Mandela said, it always seems impossible until it's done. There was a time, pretty recently actually, when my life would have seemed unimaginable. A gay woman, ordained, preaching from the pulpit, from this pulpit, with a wife I legally married, raising a daughter, with the support of this congregation, and even a few other congregations who also claim her to be theirs. Because change isn't just possible, it is a fundamental truth of life. I'll end with the words of the poem, Hymn for the Hurting, written by Amanda Gorman. Everything hurts. Our hearts, shadowed and strange, minds muddied and mute. We carry tragedy, terrifying and true, and yet none of it is new. We knew it as home, as horror, as heritage. Even our children cannot be children, cannot be. Everything hurts. It's a hard time to be alive, and even harder to stay that way. We're burdened to live out these days, while at the same time blessed to outlive them. This alarm is how we know we must be altered, that we must differ or die, that we must triumph or try. Thus, while hate cannot be terminated, it can be transformed into a love that lets us live. May we not just grieve, but give. May we not just ache, but act. May our signed right to bear arms never blind our sight from shared harm. May we choose our children over chaos. May another innocent never be lost. Maybe everything hurts, our hearts shadowed and strange. But only when everything hurts, may everything change. Amen.
If you have appreciated what you have heard, we invite you to join the conversation in person or online each week. We also invite you to make a financial gift to help First Church continue being a community that reminds us how much we are loved by our Creator. To donate, go to fccla.org/give. And share this podcast with the people you know that need to hear they are loved exactly as they are.